Hey, we'd like to welcome everybody to this week's edition of the Morning Star Men's Saturday Morning Bible Study Podcast. This week we're looking at the second in our series entitled, What Would Jesus Say? And the operative assumption is that it would be wonderful to have a meaningful conversation with Jesus, come to Him, ask Him some of the questions that we have. And so what I've taken or undertaken to do is to attempt to thoughtfully put together a list of questions that I've heard people ask, perhaps you've thought of, perhaps there are certainly things that I've thought of. What are the kinds of things that we would ask Jesus personally if we had an opportunity to sit down with Him over a cup of coffee? And here's one. Here's one that I've heard from time to time, and perhaps you have too. Maybe you've even had this question. What's up with the rules? Some of us have heard this charge that Christianity is merely a collection of do's and don'ts to be followed, and it's really restrictive, it's oppressive, and we all want to feel free. So what's up with the rules? And so today we're going to look at just that. What is the connection between rules and relationship? We say that Christianity is about relationship with God, and yet from time to time it can feel more like it's about following a collection of rules. So today we're going to look at that, and I hope that at the end of this study, you're going to have a completely different understanding and maybe have some new ability to answer friends of yours who may level that charge against Christianity. It's just a bunch of rules. So let's get into the study, guys, and hope to see you again next week. We're in our second week of the What Would Jesus Say topic. Today we're going to look at, I guess we'll call it, law and relationship. The better word for it, the kind of a subtitle that I've given to this is, why are there so many rules? So think for a moment, if it is not your impression, what is the impression that some of your friends have about, we'll just say religion in general first, and then Christianity second? It's too restrictive. What are restrictions?
Rules, guidelines.
Yeah, rules and guidelines. Yeah. And so how many of us have heard at one point or another that Christianity is merely a collection of do's and don'ts? How many of us at one time or another have struggled with do's and don'ts?
Sure.
Okay. So the question is there more than do's and don'ts? And yet we can't escape the fact that, let's face it, there are some rules. So what is the relationship between rules and connection? Or what is the connection between rules and relationship? Might be a different way of saying it. So we've all, by now, heard my definition, at least, of spiritual life. Spiritual life is how your inner man relates to the world around you is one. In other words, the created order. That's one thing. My spiritual life is how I connect with God, how I relate to myself, how I relate to all other human beings, and how I relate to the created order. So if that's true, should we be able, and if law, or rules if you will, but let's call it law because that's the way Jesus refers to it, that's the way a first century Jew would have referred to it, he or she would have referred to it as the law, does the law speak to every one of those relationships? Does the law speak to how I understand myself? Does the law speak to how I relate to God? Does the law speak to how I relate to other people? And does the law speak to how I relate to the created order? Well, the answer is yes, and I see some of you are confused, some of you are absorbed in my notes, you're really not even paying attention to what I'm saying. Work with me here. Give me some examples of what the law says about each one of these. Does the law have any examples of how I relate to the created order? I see a head nodding, but is anybody familiar with the every seventh year give the land a rest? Is everybody familiar with the rules of Jubilee that call on people to restore certain things, restore property? I mean, yes, the law speaks to how we relate to the created order. It actually even provides some guidelines for how we relate to animals and things. Not a great deal of them, but it does provide some. The law provides a great deal of guideline for how we relate to each other. What we should do, what we shouldn't do. It even provides guidelines for how we relate not only to our friends, not only to our family, but also to our enemies. We'd all have to agree that the law provides plenty of guidelines for how we relate to God. And so what I want to do now is help you to see that first and foremost, of these four components that comprise my spiritual life, how I relate to myself, then God, others, and the created order, the three flow out of my evaluation of the first. So remember when Jesus is asked the question, which are the greatest two commands? In other words, which are, in the framework of the way we're saying it this morning, which are the greatest two laws, Jesus? What does he say?
Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself.
Okay, so those two things, love God, love other people. What is the presupposition of that? There has to be a condition that exists within inside of me that allows me to love. Remember the second commandment? Love your neighbor how? So if I'm not rightly related to myself, it is impossible, even according to Jesus' own words, for me to be rightly related to anyone else. The way in which I think about myself is going to inform how I will understand and how I can possibly relate to anyone else. So if I don't love myself, if I find no value in myself, if I do not perceive that God values me, then what is each one of you to me? Or you become something to get my emptiness filled. If I do not love myself, if I cannot receive love from God because I don't think I'm worthy of that love, then every one of you becomes a device that I can use in order to have some of that emptiness filled, or someone that I can trample over in order to get what I need. And that's why we have to understand that before I can relate to God, before I can relate to any of you, before I can relate to the created order, well, I have to receive something from God that allows me to think of myself in the right way. Because if my understanding of myself, who I am, and why I'm here is corrupted or contaminated, then every other relationship that flows out of that understanding is also going to be corrupted and contaminated. Does that make sense? All right, so before we get into looking at some of the specifics of rules and relationship, let's take a look at different kinds of rules. So I've got it written down here. Some rules are discovered. Give me an example of a rule that's discovered. And remember, we defined this as what are the laws that govern all of life and what are the laws that govern my relationship to that. And we said one of the types of relationship that I have is a relationship to the created order. I'm trying to set you up for success in answering this question. So what are some of the laws that are discovered?
The law exists. All sins are outside of a man except for sexual sin. And goes against the exception of the law. And in my broken past, I've learned that that is true. And I've seen other people come to that same conclusion.
And so what you're saying is you saw something on a piece of paper, maybe, perhaps, but you didn't understand it. But because you've now experienced that, and I guess I can safely say, and experienced the consequences of that, that now you have made a discovery. The law is more than dead words. The law is a reality that has implications and application in everyday life. Is that... Yeah, that's great. All right, how about something as simple as gravity? I was actually trying to set you up for something like that, right? How many of us learn about gravity? What do you know about gravity? A lot of it you learn by experimentation. When you're a little kid, you learn how to walk or stumble or trip or fall, and all of that is learned by experimentation. We discover things. A second class of rules are ones that are given to us. So give me some examples of that. Oh, that could be a discovered one, too. That may not be a given one. He said, don't stick your hand in the light socket.
That's the parent told me that.
A parent told you that, but that was probably like the first one. You didn't really believe it was true, and so you went and experimented to find out if it was. Now you know why. Now you know why it's a rule. That's another one, right? That applies to gravity. All right, on a more serious level, though, what are some of the laws that are given to us? Okay, so that's a government, a man-made rule. All right? Any others? Don't go through a red light. We're actually going to use traffic lights as an example later on. Don't go through a red light. Okay, so you're all experienced with rules in driving. Any other rules? The Ten Commandments. Okay, God has given us some rules for how to live. So certain rules are given to us. They're expected to be applied, we'll say, more or less universally. And then some are created. Give me an example of them. Okay, do you have your rules in your family? Give rules in your relationships. I mean, maybe for instance, there's something that goes like, in this family we always, or in this family we never. Now, I don't know, maybe your kids have tested the limits of both of them. Here's some. Churches are filled with rules. Jesus confronted this. But it's no different for us. So let's suppose that we agree that we're going to meet as a body of believers on Sunday morning. We don't have to do it then, but we do it then. So we say that we're going to meet on Sunday morning. Can you see that there would be some man-made rules that would be necessary in order to facilitate that? Give me some examples. What's that? Don't park on the lawn. That could be a discovered rule. Okay, when the lawn is no longer a lawn and it's now mud, we develop a rule for it, don't we? But as a matter of fact, human beings usually develop rules to fix problems. Give me some other examples. Is anyone awake here this morning? Yes, a starting time. If I want to show up at 11 and you want to show up at 7, we're not going to have much fellowship. So we have to agree on a starting time. Anything else? See, the church is filled with rules. Why? To create order and maintain order. Now, is that good or bad?
It can be both. It starts out good, usually.
And that's the way it is with rules. So now let me give you an example of something that would be extreme. Have you ever wondered why people a generation ago always wore suits, usually, to church? Did you?
Well, you got to have your hair cut a certain way or not cut a certain way. Without reverence.
It was out of reverence. You can imagine that it started out as a good thing, right? I mean, here comes, I don't know, let's say Farmer Joe, and he's fresh from a week of mucking the stalls, and he has one set of clothes, and Farmer Joe comes to church in the one set of clothes that he owns, and they haven't been laundered recently. And he sits next to the town folk who have freshly laundered clothes, and you can imagine that there's not a great deal of fellowship that takes place there that morning. And so over a period of time, there's exactly like don't park on the lawn. We discover that there are some things that don't facilitate good relationship, and so what do? We create some rules to try to overcome those impediments to good relationship. Well, what happens over a period of time, though? Pretty soon what became a rule so as to facilitate something becomes a benchmark by which we judge whether people are in or out. Okay, so today, maybe we have a starting time. Let's say that we have a starting time for our church of 10 o'clock. I'm trying to make it a church that's not like ours. So we'll say we have a starting time at 10 o'clock. What was the rule intended to do? Bring us together and bring us together at the right time, because there is some great value in all of us being together at the same time. You may bring something that I need. I may need something that you bring. If we don't connect at the same time, that isn't made possible. But now over a period of time, what happens is that some people begin to judge the quality of your spiritual sincerity based on what time you show up. So if you show up at, what time did I say it was? 10 o'clock? If you show up at 9:45 and I show up at 11:20, other people on the outside start to make judgments. I'm not really serious about this. You are. Therefore, you're the more spiritual person and I'm somehow less spiritual. And so now what's happened to what was a good rule intended to bring us together and unite us? It's become used as a benchmark by which we judge each other. Now, I'm trying to pick the simplest, most easy to understand things. I'm hoping that you're going to remember this and carry this away with you and start to evaluate the way you look at other people in situations, the way they may look at you, and how rules over a period of time, if we're not careful, start to get distorted. What was meant for good turns into something used for harm.
Yeah, it begins to be divisive and judgmental. You know? I can bring you ridiculous examples that I've seen from my childhood in my life. Oh, yeah. You know, I can go back 30-some years when we started to bring guitars and drums and everything into the service. And, oh, the people that didn't like that, they had problems with that. Try to show them the songs, everything, all the instruments, everything had praise unto the Lord. Problems with that. No, it has to be the organ and the piano. You know, those kind of crazy things.
I was saying that same thing. When the law becomes church split instead of a church plant.
All right, so now that we've introduced the topic, I want to tell you why. And the why we're looking at this is not only that you and I, somewhere within us, have embedded some tensions and frustrations about rule and law. We've been on the bad side of rule, where it didn't demonstrate grace, and we may have some issues. And you think you don't have any issues anymore, and I may think I don't have any issues anymore, but the reality is that some of the bad experiences that we have had in the past still live in us, and it's helpful to get this stuff out in the open and discuss it. But the other really important reason is that many people who never experienced the grace and the love of God fail to do that because they're hung up on this idea of rules. By the end of this morning, I hope that we're going to have a framework that allows you, if you get the chance to have such a discussion, to have an intelligent and creative way to share this concept with people. So before we go any further, I got to give a little bit of credit to Tim Keller for some of the ideas that we're going to look at this morning. I've built a lot onto that, but it wouldn't be right if I just took the credit for all that. And then subsequent to that, I heard something that Andy Stanley said, and I'm pretty sure Andy barred Tim's stuff too, because what Andy said was came out after what Tim said, and it just seemed like, what a coincidence. But anyway, so here we are. We live in a world where rules are essential, but how we apply the rules in our everyday relationships is an element of creativity. So somebody used the example of a traffic light before, and the traffic light is a marvelous illustration. What does green say?
Go.
What does red say?
Keep going.
I've met guys that they're sure that's what that means. Okay. Ideally, green means go. Red means stop. What does yellow mean?
Go fast.
See? What does yellow mean? Yellow means depending on where you are. So let's imagine that you and your wife are on your way to go out to eat. There's no hurry. You've had a relaxing day. You're meeting another couple there, but you've left a half an hour early. What does yellow mean? Slow down, take it easy, and stop. You're the same man. Monday morning, you have a flat tire in the driveway, so you are now 15 minutes late to leave for work, and you were cutting it close before you walked out and saw the flat tire. What does yellow mean?
There is no yellow.
There is no yellow. There is only green. Same guy, same car, maybe even the same traffic light. We live in the land of yellow. And that's the truth. Because most of us on a day-to-day basis need to discern how we interact with the rules that are given to us. Now, what's the purpose to the traffic light to begin with?
Prevent an accident.
Prevent an accident. If we get to it, and we may not, but if we get to it, there's a place where Paul is writing to the Galatians, and he says to them that when humanity was young, it was given the law, and what was the law? It was the guardian to bring mankind along and help them to discern right from wrong. It was to help them, to teach them how to relate to each other, how to relate to God, how to relate to the created order. And they were not wise enough at that time, Paul says, in order to respond well. And so they needed a legal guardian to basically tell them, this is how you do this. This is what you do. And you see an element of that in the law. Well, so how many of you gave your kids rules? Or are giving your kids rules? But the application of those rules as adults looks a little different. Now, maybe this next question isn't going to make sense to you, but is there a time in your life where a rule that you carried through from childhood to adulthood, for the first time you asked the question, why do I still do this way? You're shaking your head. Everybody else maybe not. I don't know. I mean, I know that there's a lot of things that I carried through from my childhood to adulthood, and I had to at some point in time say, why did my parents give this rule to me? What was the purpose behind the rule? And so in that, now I start to be able to steward the purpose of the law and not the legality of the law. Does that make sense? And this is the task that each one of us is given as adults. We have to decide what to do with the yellow in our life. How many of you have ever heard the phrase that a lot of things are not black and white, they're different shades of gray? Don't we struggle with that? What do you and I do with whether you want to call it gray or whether you want to call it yellow? How do we manage the yellow or the gray in life? And it's determined in part by what your view of law is.
You know, talking about laws and the different examples that he gave, it keeps coming to my mind is circumstance.
Is what?
Circumstance.
Okay.
We're talking about law. Yellow light because you know you were short on time for that tire. And then the other example on the other side was that you know, hey, you got all the time in the world, so you go ahead and stop. So based on your circumstance, then that obscures your view of the law. I don't know where I'm going with it, but I mean it's you know, we can twist the rules to make it fit in our circumstance.
Okay. That's why. No, that's why I asked, what is the purpose to the traffic light?
Order, safety, and order.
Order, safety. That, it depends, doesn't it? If you were to ask the local municipality who has a cop hidden behind the billboard, what's the purpose to that traffic light, what would that municipality's answer be? It generates a heck of a lot of revenue every month, and we need that traffic light in this town. Maybe nobody else but me understands what I'm saying right now, but So each one of us has to decide, yes, there it's circumstance, but I have to decide in that moment which I value more, punctuality at work or the safety of someone else. And that becomes a value. Yes.
Say that again, that phrase. I have to determine.
I have to determine in the moment which value I prize most. My punctuality at work or the safety of others who may be potentially harmed if I intersect or go through. Go ahead.
Now, I didn't look ahead, but I'm sure you're going to get to this. This is what Jesus is teaching, the law of love governs our lives. Law taught that, the law of love. It'd be okay for me, but what about you? So you're more important, I value you. So what may be okay for me to do isn't for you. So because of love for you, I'm not going to do certain things because you're very important. I don't want to cause you to stumble or fall.
Okay, so now that we've rushed ahead and cut out two-thirds of the lesson, we can get right to the part where we can all go home early. That is true. Okay, so what Ron said was that in that moment where you make the determination as to whether you're going to be on time for work or whether you're going to regard the safety of others more highly, that you're taking the law into your own hands and making your own law.
That's good.
Yeah, absolutely. But aren't there times in our human relationships, and we're using the traffic light illustration because it's easy to understand and it's memorable. I hope you're going to carry the green, red, and yellow thing with you into your everyday thinking. But don't we have that circumstance that we have to deal with in our relationships all the time? So we have rules for how we relate to each other. But what happens when something comes up and we have a really tough dilemma as to how we understand that? Just like John said, this is okay, this is not okay. Which do I do in this in a particular circumstance? Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians, the first chapter. And while you're turning there, I want to wrap up this idea of green, red, and yellow with this idea. This is the first thing that you are going to be able to have a conversation with a friend about. The law gives a scaffolding or a basic superstructure on which we build our own creative application of that that brings richness to relationship. If you try to have a relationship with another human being based solely on law and rule, how will it go for you? It'll be pretty rigid. It'll be pretty tight, right? There'll be a lot of measurement that takes place, won't there? Think about that. You'll spend half of your time in that relationship measuring. How's that person doing? How am I doing? Have you ever been under scrutiny all the time? Maybe at work? Maybe in a relationship where there was no trust? What does it feel like to live your life under constant scrutiny? You may have found that you actually make more mistakes when you're constantly being scrutinized than when you're free to just live normally. And this is what I want us to understand. And this is something that you need to share with friends who may have experienced a bad dose of rules and religion and misunderstand that to be relationship with God. That rules are essential and rules are necessary, but rules without creative flexibility to apply them in particular circumstances becomes horribly rigid. We're going to start at verse 4. Chapter 1. I give thanks to my God always for you because of the grace of God that was given you in Christ Jesus. That in every way you were enriched in Him in all speech and all knowledge, even as the testimony about Christ was confirmed among you, so that you are not lacking in any gift as you wait for the revealing of our Lord Jesus Christ. Okay, now we've said this a lot. Paul needs better punctuation. Paul needs to put more periods and consolidate ideas. He's not really good at that. But here's what we do know. Here's what Paul is saying. Have you ever heard this phrase, I love you in the Lord? Come on. Yeah, right. What does that mean? You're never quite sure. Does the person really like you? Right. Does the person really like you? Or does it take everything that Jesus is doing in them for them to be able to stomach you? So it's not really a very affirming statement. Here's what Paul is saying. And it actually is affirming. He's saying, and keep in mind, that I need to parenthetically insert this. This book is extremely valuable to us in this church. We're not a second generation church yet. See, in a second and a third generation church, there are just the majority of the people often have grown up in that church. They are the sons and the daughters and the grandsons and the granddaughters of the founders of that church. And so they have grown up not only with Christianity, but with the culture and the rules and just the overall feel and texture of that church. This is not that kind of a church. We are actually not that kind of a church. There are people coming into our church every week who have limited past church experience or maybe no past church experience. They don't have a set of expectations. They don't know the code. They don't know the secret handshake and all the rules. And we don't even have them yet. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so when Paul writes to these guys and some people who have been in the church, and it's like their great-great-grandparents grew up in that church, they look at this and they say, what's wrong with these people? How do you know how to live in Christian community if you've never seen Christian community before? How do you know right from wrong in Christian community or in family or in any other circumstance if you've never seen it before? And these people have never seen it before. So when Paul says to them, I give thanks to God for you, what he's really saying is, I didn't know you before. I didn't know the old you. But I can clearly see the new you and everything that God is doing in you. Now for some of us, we have a past, huh? Now, maybe there's somebody that knows the old you. And if they knew the old you, and then they knew the new you, they'd say, wow, what a transformation. Maybe there's some of these people that Paul actually knows a little bit from before. But what he's saying is, this is not one of these statements where he's saying, I love you in the Lord. What he's really saying is, wow, I am seeing some amazing stuff in you. Turn over to 2 Corinthians 5, just so we get the feel for this. Same group of people that he's writing to. We'll just start at what I guess is verse 16. From now on, therefore, we regard no one according to the flesh. Even though we once regarded Christ according to the flesh, we regard him thus no longer. Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old has passed away, and behold, the new has come. And so what he is saying to this group of people is, I see the new that Christ is doing in you, and I'm really thankful to God for it. And I'm not only thankful to God for what I see Christ doing in Ron, and I'm not only thankful for what he's doing in you, boy, he's had his hands full with you, hasn't he? But he's brought all of you together, and what he's doing with you, working with you, the new Ron and the new Vinny working together, it's amazing. And really good things are happening. And so we should stop right there, right? Because we say, well, wow, this is a perfect community. Let's go down to verse 10. I appeal to you, brothers, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that all of you agree and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be united in the same mind and the same judgment. Well, now, if Christ is working in Ron, and Christ is working in Vinny, and Christ is working in the working of them working together, and all this good stuff is coming out of that, he's barely had a chance to inhale and catch his breath before in the next statement he says what? Why would I need to tell you guys to be united? I didn't need to tell you to wear a shirt this morning, did I?
I did get the
email. Oh, did you? See, you knew to wear that, right? Why would I need to tell a group of people that they needed to be united?
There's still differences.
and they're still divided. And despite the wonderful work that Christ is doing there, each of us has a past and each of us has personal experiences. And we relate to other people based on our past and our personal experiences. He's very specific about this. It's not just a general, can't we all just shake hands and love each other? Look at the way he words it. That there be no division among you, but that you be united in the same mind and the same judgments. What does that mean to us? Let's not worry about what it meant to them, other than for how that applies to us. What will it mean to us to be united in the same mind and the same judgments? Think about the traffic light. 100 people are going to have to go through that light during that cycle of the light. What does it mean for us to be united in the same mind? We have to value and think about the traffic light and its purpose in that society, and we have to think about it in the same way. So if you think about that traffic light as an inconvenience that gets in your way, and if there's any way possible for you to do something to get around the rules of the light, you're going to do it, and he thinks differently, how are the two of you going to interact when you both come to the light? And so what Paul is saying is, no matter what your past is, no matter what the good work that God is doing in you now, each of us needs to have conversation. And this is difficult. If you ever watch any political television, you know how difficult this can be when people whose minds are not united based on their past and based on their experience, and they come together and in all earnestness and sincerity, they express their point of view, and the other person says, basically, are you nuts? That's not the way it works. This is difficult stuff, to be united in mind and in the same judgments. So if the mind is the way I think, what is judgment? See, you thought this was a simple verse, didn't you? What's judgment? It's how I interpret what I'm thinking. It's how I interpret and then live out what I'm thinking. So if we don't share the same assumptions about the purpose for the light, what are our judgments about what to do with the light going to be? If we don't share the same assumptions about why God puts laws into our society, what are our judgments about those laws going to be? If I have the assumption that God only loves me when I obey the law, but if I could somehow hide my disobedience from God so it wouldn't make Him love me less, how am I going to treat the law? Now, take somebody else who says, the only reason that law could possibly exist is because in some way or another it is good for me and everyone around me. How will that influence my judgment about what to do? Are you all lost or deep in thought? Because I have never seen such blank stares. And I've seen a lot of blank stares in my life.
Some people are like, oh, well, it's not condemned. If you knock down the brick wall, there's a reason that wall was there. So there's no like natural laws out there in the universe. If we take them away, there's a reason they were there. If we take them away, we can see the consequences.
Let's build a little bit on what he just said. Can we see examples in society over the last 100 years of where laws were questioned, the validity of laws and assumptions that we had about the purpose for law have gradually been called into question to the extent that we have thrown them off, and are we better off for the throwing off of some of those laws? Okay. Sometimes we'd say a law is what? Okay. Are there laws that we throw off that are good for us? And incidentally, slavery was what? Essentially, what we would call the legalization of slavery was a created law. It was man-made. And we started to structure law around not the best for everyone, but the best for a handful. This is why people struggle, incidentally, with God's law. You took me down a side road. I hadn't intended to go down that road. But since we're on it, we may as well all go along for the ride. When you and I view the rules or the laws that God gives us through the filter of personal benefit, we may resist. Has there ever been a time when complying with, let's say, one of God's laws has been a problem for you? It's been difficult for you. You've questioned it. But if we look at God's law as the best for all of us instead of one of us, it changes the dynamic. And so the traffic light isn't just there to make your life happy. It is there to make everybody's life safer. When you and I look at law as being there solely to serve us, then we're likely to want to tear it down. This is another judgment issue. What is the reason behind the law? Is the law there only to make me happy and fulfilled? Or does the law serve a bigger purpose? And I think most of us, even your friends who get hung up on rules, they're not hung up on the rule because they couldn't appreciate its benefit for all society. Somehow, as Ron said, they think that they personally are above the law and it shouldn't apply to them because they're more sophisticated. And it's impeding their personal pleasure or happiness.
It makes me think of the laws for riding motorcycles with no helmets. Yeah. I was fighting for years. And most of the time I wore a helmet because I was going way too fast to fall off and not have one. So not only did I not make the speed of the helmet, but it was good that I had to wear my helmet. And then when they came out with, I don't need a helmet in Pennsylvania, I got rid of my bike because I was not in a condition of self-control where I could still maintain my ability to ride a bike at 180 without a helmet. And the good law that we let go of, how many more lives are lost now because it's taken that ability away so that people on bikes can feel free. There's consequences. Many more bikers have been lost in 3 years since their law went into action. The previous, when a helmet law was in place.
Mm-hmm. And so, to speak to what you're saying, for the sake of a little bit of freedom, sometimes we sacrifice our long-term good. And not only that, suppose that your neighbor would ride 55 with no helmet for the rest of his life because he was self-disciplined. You, on the other hand, exert a little bit less self-discipline, and you wanted to apply the no-helmet law, but you didn't want to apply the restriction of going 55, and so you'd rather go 155.
That would be first year.
You'll have next week to tell that story. I'd be here if I was you, because it sounds like it's going to be an interesting story. Turn over to Matthew 5.
When you talk about laws, then they can get ridiculous, but if you have a bicycle, you have to wear a helmet. If you have a car, you have to wear a seatbelt.
Yep.
But a motorcycle, you don't need a helmet.
So when you're inside a good solid steel structure, you still need to be strapped in. When you can fall off the structure at any time and there's no protection, you don't need absolutely nothing. All right. We have looked at this text before. We're going to go to Matthew 5, the 17th verse. Let me give you a little bit of parenthetical information here. We return sometimes to scriptures again and again for this reason. We not only want to be able to bore down into particular texts and become experts at understanding a particular text, but we need to be able to understand how it connects to everything else. So we're coming back to this, not in the same light as we did the last time we looked at it, but we're coming back to this text in the context of considering law. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota or a dot will pass away from the law until all is accomplished. So what he's saying is, if we were to put it into a little bit more modern language, you know all the laws, guys, that you're familiar with? Even the periods matter. We're not even going to take away the periods and the commas or the dots on the I's. So if you thought that I was coming to liberate you from the law, you're wrong. You have two choices at that moment. Remember what Paul said? United in mind, united in judgment. We're going to look at this through a judgment mindset now. If you hear Jesus say that, what do you think? You thought I was coming to give you more liberty and more freedom and more room to roam, that you could ride not only without a helmet, you could ride naked on your bike. You thought that that was my mission in life. What?
So was that all?
You should be here next week. It's going to be a great story. Now, somebody else hears that, and they're okay with the law. So your response at that moment is going to be defined by your understanding of the purpose for the law. So if you think that obedience to God makes God happy with you, what have you just heard? If you think that obedience to God makes God happy with you, what you see there is, oh my word, there's not going to be a moment's rest for me for the rest of my life. For the rest of my life, I am going to have to perform and perform and perform. And the moment that I don't perform, God is no longer going to love me. We're going somewhere with this, in case you're curious. But if you believe that the purpose of the law is to facilitate relationship between God and man, and man and man, then what do you hear there? The structure and framework that you have come to count on, to rely on, for how you will relate to each other, it is going to stand in place. And then Jesus goes on from there so as to confirm exactly what was intended. He says, guys, I think you've misunderstood the law all along. God isn't happy with you because you obey the law. And this is the next point that I said we're headed toward. Because if you believe that God is only happy with you when you obey Him, then it all depends on you and your obedience. And so, here's where I'm going to borrow on the Tim Keller idea. When God takes the people out of Egypt and brings them into relationship with Him, which comes first, the Exodus or the mountain experience where the law is given? God calls people into relationship with Him first, and after they are in relationship with Him, He gives them rules to live by. This is huge. So, think about this. I'm a citizen of the United States. Do the rules of France apply to me? Why? And I have no relationship with France. The rules only apply so long as the relationship exists. Relationship precedes rule. Now, if I go to France as a tourist, do the rules of France apply to me? Yes, because my relationship there is as a tourist. Do the rules of citizenship apply to me if I'm a tourist in France? No, only the rules of a tourist apply to me. And so in that sense, the deeper the relationship, the more the rules. So that my connection with something always mandates what the quality of the relationship will be. Let me give you another example. So suppose I were to say to Ron, I expect you to be faithful to me and never cheat on me for the rest of your life. How does that sound?
That sounds really odd. That's really scary.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? Why? Incidentally, Ron, I don't care. You can cheat on me at will. I encourage it, as a matter of fact. What's wrong about that statement? The relationship that Ron and I have is a relationship of friendship. And so the same kinds of rules don't apply in that relationship as they might to between Ron and his wife. So the rules and the relationship are always connected. The quality of the relationship dictates a certain type of rule. The specificity of the relationship dictates a certain type of rule. So this is the big point. First and foremost, God calls people into relationship first and then gives them rules that facilitate the relationship. Which came first? Your child or the rules of the household by which he would live? The child came first. Unless you were some sick pup that sat up late at night crafting rules for what your kid would do once he was born. But in most people's cases, it was the other way around. And the rules were developed for what reason? Keep them safe, and then you had two kids, or three or four. Keep them safe and keep you sane, and keep them sane, right? Keep them from killing each other. So the rules were intended for a blessing, not a curse. You were no less their father when they beat each other up. As a matter of fact, sometimes you had to be more their father when they beat each other up. But it didn't take away from the relationship.
Same rules, same household.
So here's the next thing. If you and I look at rules as the means by which God is happy with us, what happens as soon as we break the rule? The relationship is now severed. What kind of a relationship do you and I have with anything so long as the relationship is on again, off again? Maybe you can think back to if you ever, back in your distant past, if you dated somebody and it was always a performance-based thing. Or maybe you have a friend and if you don't do the right thing, they're not your friend for the week. Some of you might have experienced that, maybe some of you haven't. Here's the next thing. In a rules-based situation where the relationship is based on rules, I am obligated because you obeyed the rules. So this is another really deep point. If I've said, this is what I expect you to do, but the relationship is off if you don't, then I am now obligated if you obey the rule. And so you never know if I really prize and treasure you. You only know that I'm contractually obligated to you because you've obeyed the law. But if you and I are in covenant relationship, then you know that it is not your obedience that forces me to love you. It is my commitment to you that causes me to love you, and you can rest freely in that commitment. That changes everything. Because the law breaker or the law performer influences the relationship in contract. But in covenant relationship, it is my commitment to you apart from your behavior that determines the relationship. Now, I know that's a lot to explain, but if you can get that basic concept inside yourself and then find a means to communicate that to others, that's extremely liberating. The only purpose for law is to facilitate relationship. But now we're going to look at our tendency. Incidentally, maybe it would be time to stop and ask if there's any questions or comments. I've been rattling on for a while. All right. There never seem to be any comments. You're sure you're all awake, right? going to look at three final words here that we're going to consider. The first is competition, the second is cooperation, and the third is submission. And we're going to take them in order. But these are the three choices that we have about how we will relate to each other. And this is actually the fulfillment of the law. What do we do in the way of relating to each other? So competition essentially says that I'm going to do whatever I can to beat you because there's a limited something that is available, and if I can get it first, then I win and I don't care what you get. Cooperation says something different. Now think about this in relationship before we go into cooperation. In relationship, competition says if there is a limited amount of something, I'd better get mine first. What is that assumption built on? Does that seem to fit God's kingdom model for living? It doesn't sound right, but why? See, we just inherently sort of suspect that that's probably not God's way, but why? Okay, that's true. But is there not some component of survival built into you? But would you say that it's bad for you to look out for yourself?
That's the primary goal, yeah.
Are you the steward of your life?
In my sinful nature, yes.
Are you the steward of your life in your non-sinful nature? I think you are.
But I would be driven by faith and motive.
Based on... Okay, I'm trying to lead you and you're not following that direction, so I'm just going to have to take you where I want you to go, and if you don't like that result, then so be it. Here's the thing. Yes, we are stewards of our lives. And yes, survival does matter. But if the only person that I have to trust on for my survival is me, then it is incumbent on me to do everything possible within my power to survive. But if I am a steward, there's an assumption. Where does stewardship come from? I can't be a steward unless I am given a trust to steward. And so who has given me that trust? See, if I am a steward, God has given me the trust, and then God becomes my source of supply. And so in a world without God, competition is the only logical and sensible outcome. Do you hear me? In a world where God exists and God chooses to be intimately involved with people, then competition is no longer essential, but it is still something that appeals to us. We're drawn to it. But as a steward doesn't want to compete. A steward wants to serve. All right, now we'll move from competition. And I hope I might have made that too confusing. Do I need to go over that again, or did that make sense? Everybody gets that? Okay. What does cooperation say? Because cooperation now sounds very noble. So I no longer need to compete. If God is in the world and God has given me a trust and God is responsible for providing the resources necessary. But cooperation sounds great, but what underlies cooperation? In many cases, cooperation is built based on the assumption that we share common goals, Vinny and I. But Vinny has certain skills and I have certain other skills. And if we can combine them, then we'll have a better outcome. But underlying that, what's the interest? It's my self-interest and his self-interest. I pointed that backwards. I said my self-interest and his self-interest, and that was not right. And it presupposes that he and I together can do something, but what does that end up doing? It sets us up in competition. So now it's not Vinny against the world, or Ron against the world, or me against the world. Now it's us against the world. Submission says something different. And this is where we get to what Vinny was trying to get to. Submission says, because I can trust in God as my source, I can lay down my right, and in that sense, I can serve. I can use the law and apply the law to serve other people. I don't need to game the law to get what I want. I can use the law as a guideline by which I look out for the best of other people. So we come back to what Jesus says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. What do I want for myself? Vinny, what do you want for yourself? I've put you on the spot a lot today. Let's... Oh no, you don't talk. Boy, what do you want for yourself? Yeah. And so every morning now when I wake up, I have the privilege of saying, what are the things that I need most, hope for most, want most, and how can I go out and how can I help other people to have those very types of things? What's important to me? How can I help other people to have those same things? We're going back to 1 Corinthians. Maybe I told you that already. Going to the 20th verse of the first chapter. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? Now, that sounds kind of judgmental, and it would have almost been in their face as a challenge, considering who he's writing to. For since the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God, for the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. And then he needs this next text to explain what he's just said, because this is just the way Paul writes. Here's what I said, and now I'm going to explain what I said. For consider your calling, brothers, not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Now you could take offense at that, but the reality is, what he's saying is, here's a cross-section of your church. Some of you are scholars, some of you are philosophers, but that's not many of you. A lot of you are ordinary, everyday working people, and wisdom isn't your strong suit. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. Again, he's describing a cross-section of the church. But God chose what was foolish, or what is foolish, in the world to shame the wise. Now, if you're not careful, what is the assumption that you make about what Paul just said? Yeah, but if you're not careful about the subtlety of the way he words that, you assume, well, wait a minute. So are you saying that I'm a fool, but God's chosen this foolish person to make it? No, that's not what he's saying. It's an explanation of what came before. So God chose what is foolish in the world. Well, what was foolish? He just talked about it above. The cross of Christ is foolishness. And so what he's saying is, God has chosen this foolishness that is what? Submission. God has chosen the foolishness of submission to create the favorable terms of relationship. You and I would not choose to create relationship through submission that way. What he's saying is, every one of you has this basic experience from the past. I cause other people to submit to me, and that facilitates relationship. And if you understand God in that way, he's saying, then you don't understand God. If you understand God as being one who is authoritative to the point that he is going to force relationship on you, you've missed the point. What you need to understand is that God cared about you so much that He came and submitted to human institutions, laid down His life in order to facilitate that relationship. It's the exact opposite of what they would have expected. They would have expected power and dominion and authority to come and exert itself over them, and that would be the God that they would have thought was the real God. He says, no, you don't understand. And the reality is this, and this is why. Can you truly love someone freely who asserts authority and power forcefully over you? I can respect them, I can submit to them, but can I treasure them in my heart? The only way that I can treasure something is if I can see that it demonstrates care and compassion for me. You know that cheesy old phrase, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care? Okay, we could say that maybe that is the ultimate interpretation of this thing right here. That God's ultimate demonstration of the fact that He cares that much is that He submitted to what was necessary to submit to through Jesus Christ in order to restore us to relationship. And that is completely the antithesis of what they would have expected. Let me finish reading this. For consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to the world's standards. Not many of you were powerful. Not many of you were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to nothing, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. So not only does He say that God chose to reach humanity through the exact opposite means that humanity would have expected, but if you were God, who would you pick? If you were God, which people would you pick to be in relationship to? The good ones, the beautiful people. The good-looking people, the smart people, the clever people, the creative people, right? If you were God, isn't that who we want for family? Isn't that who we want for friends sometimes? And I know you're all looking at me judgmentally thinking, well, what kind of a mind does he have? But the reality is that in a certain sense, isn't that kind of what we want? Nobody wants to be embarrassed by their friends or their family. Here's the amazing thing. God is not embarrassed by us. Like, if God had 20 other God-type people that He hung out with, He'd point to us and He'd say, those are my clan, those are my guys. God wouldn't be embarrassed by us. See, sometimes you and I are embarrassed by our family, we're embarrassed by our friends. Paul's saying, God chose you guys. I don't know if at that moment they actually could even receive that as being much of a compliment. Yeah, God chose you. Go figure. So God did the exact opposite of what we would expect. He laid down His life and submitted to the law in order to redeem us. And God chose the least likely of us. Not the beautiful people, but everybody to be in relationship with Him. And so what I hope that we are going to take away from this is, A, you and I live in the tension between the green and the red, that most of law is about how we seek to creatively apply it in our day-to-day life. We have to understand the purpose of the law before we can practically apply it well. The next thing is that relationship always precedes rule. So whether it's in your own life or in the life of a friend that's struggling to understand the basic principle of the gospel is not first and foremost about rule, the gospel is first and foremost about relationship, and the only purpose to the rule is to facilitate relationship. And when we get that backwards, we misunderstand God and we do God a great disservice. And that's why finally, okay, this is my final extra point thing here. When we seek to judge the people of this world by the rule of God, we're doing exactly the same thing as when we would expect the people of France to obey our laws. They're not bound by the rule of God until they are bound in the relationship of God. And sometimes we judge people and say, well, they should this, or don't they that, or why don't they this, or don't they know that's wrong? Well, first off, no, they don't know it's wrong. Maybe they don't understand it's wrong. And lastly, they're not bound by that because they are not in fellowship with God. And it's exactly like applying a different country's rules to our life.
That's good. We can't expect Christian behavior out of non-Christians. It's hard enough for us who aren't Christians.
Yeah, right. It's hard enough for us who are. And we are compelled by the love of God in order to do it.
Yes, we have help. We have